Welcome to the Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com.
The Wheel of Time is an epic fantasy series created by Robert Jordan.
At its conclusion, the series will consist of 14 novels and one prequel novel.
Sadly, Robert Jordan did not live to see his work complete.
Brandon Sanderson, appointed by Mr. Jordan's widow, Harriet Rigney, will complete the series with the novels The Gathering Storm, Towers of Midnight, and A Memory of Light, based on the notes left by Mr. Jordan.
This podcast is dedicated to discussing and enjoying the monumental work of fiction that is The Wheel of Time. Welcome, everyone, to another edition of The Fourth Age, a Wheel of Time podcast brought to you by DragonMount.com. I, of course, am Andrew Gellos, and with us this week is Virginia.
Hi, Andrew. Great to be here, as always. And we also have with us tonight, Morgan.
Hi, guys. I always love coming to this.
Well, it's great to have you back again.
This episode, we will be continuing our multiple-part series with The Knife of Dreams before The Gathering Storm comes out. Before we do that, though, we would like to mention some news from DragonMount.com. This, of course, is What You Should Know. In addition to Chapter 2 being available to download on audio format online, we have received word now that the final two books of the series, Book 13 and 14, have gotten official names. The 13th book will be entitled Towers of Midnight, and the 14th book, and final in the series, as Mr. Jordan wanted it, will be entitled A Memory of Light.
I think that's great. I really like those titles. I think it's much, much stronger than Shifting Winds. Towers of Midnight is just probably much more descriptive, and I really like it. And I'm really glad that they're using A Memory of Light after all, because I would have felt really bad if Jordan's title had not actually ever been used. And Brandon Sanderson actually does discuss the reasoning and the process leading up to this decision quite a bit on his blog. So you can go to brandonsanderson.com and find out a little bit more about his thought processes and reasoning behind it.
On Brandon's site, you can also find a current progress report on Towers of Midnight. Currently, he has it set at a little under 60% finished. He did say that it would be kind of slow going because this particular book has a lot of editing which needs to be done to it. But he does hope to be finished late in 2009 for a publication late in 2010, almost a year following the release of The Gathering Storm.
That's right. That was the initial plan, was for them to release one every fall, you know, after The Gathering Storm is out. So basically we have another two full years before we get the last book. I really want it now.
Demetrid, how fares this world?
It is on edge, my lord. All the readers await Tarmon Gaidon. They seem to expect the light to triumph. They cannot understand the glory of the shadow.
The chosen dwindle, Demetrid. The weak fall away. I cannot save those who disregard spoiler warnings. Even I cannot step outside of time. Done by my ancient enemies, the podcasters of the Fourth Age. Would you unleash the spoilers in my service, Demetrid?
As you command, great lord, so shall I obey.
So you shall. Would you be nameless?
I wish only to serve you, great lord, however I may.
Then listen and serve. Hear who will die and who will live in chapters of books not yet released.
With no further ado, we shall return to our ongoing series, How You Got Knifed Again in Your Sleep. I mean, the Knife of Dreams recap.
Strangely enough, no knives feature in this book at all that I can remember, other than the little quote at the beginning, which now I have to dredge up since I mentioned it. This podcast should be one long apology to the editors.
I thought somebody did get knifed in this one.
I don't know. But they're going to knife us if we don't get this straight. All right, then the only knife that I can remember in A Knife of Dreams is, there may be others, is the quote in the very beginning of the book, which is, "The sweetness of victory and the bitterness of defeat are alike a knife of dreams," from Fog and Steel by Madoc Camadron. which, as we know, is Matt's favorite book. We'll continue our Knife of Dreams summary with Chapter 3, which is entitled At the Gardens. The entire chapter is written from Arengar's point of view, and it begins with Moradin summoning the Forsaken to a meeting in Teleronriad. Grendel, the Mondred, and Messana, and Semirog are already there when Arengar arrives, and Grendel stands sipping wine while observing the other three, who are in close conversation. The room is the image of the now-destroyed Anseline Gardens, a popular destination for fine dining, wines, and gambling in and gambling in the Age of Legends, featuring immense stylized sculptures by Cormelin Massoon, which tower over fabulous buildings as delicate as if made from spinglass. Grendel, wearing strife, arrives first, and she chose the setting. Messana looks wan, and Arengar speculates that she may be ill. Arengar then wonders, why are there 11 chairs? Since Asmodian, Samael, Valal, and Robin are dead, and Osangar has not been seen since the debacle at Shar-Lagoth. Beautiful but creepy mind-reading Zomara, first created by Aghanar, serve wine to the attendees. Arengar has no doubt that Moradin is Jamiel, and she believes that he must have found a stasis box stuffed full with dozens of Zomaran. Arengar found 2 stasis boxes herself, but they contained nothing of interest to her. Arengar envies Grendel's strife dress, and she wishes it were hers. She wears an emerald necklace, which she obtained from Delana, but her low-cut, high-slit-at-the-thighs dress is a creation of Teleronriad, though her own abilities there are rather weak. She can only find Egwene's dreams when she is right beside her. She also plans to use Grendel for her useful skills and her wider contacts with Dark Friends. During the meeting, actually before the meeting, Arengar propositions Grendel with an alliance, both political and intimate, and Grendel's gown turns black as midnight in Larchin. Demondred is offended that Arengar is fondling Grendel in front of him. Messana then comes over, and she is as angry as a hissing career because Arengar lost Egwene, and she believes that the rebellion will now fall apart. Arengar tells her that the rebels intend to continue on. Messana is somewhat mollified by this, and she declares that she will wait until Elida breaks Egwene to rescue her, and she will not say where Egwene is being held. Moradin, now Nablus, arrives, leading Mogedion and Sindane. He then tells them that he will decide when and where and whether Egwene is to be released. He sits, and Mogedion and Sindane sit beside him. The other Forsaken take their chairs, Arengar sitting close enough to touch Grendel. Moradin says that Samael, or someone disguised as him, ordered 100 Myrdral and thousands of Trollocs into the waves, and says that as the Myrdral obeyed, it must have been one of the Chosen. He is annoyed, but confesses that he does not know what their orders were. Moradin orders them to report any sightings of Myrdral or Trollocs outside the Blight to him, immediately. Only he knows what was done to Messana for punishment, but she is obviously cowed by him. Moradin then orders them to locate the 3 remaining seals. He expressly forbids Sindane to go near Rand because he knows that she would kill him rather than question him about the seals. He orders that no one but himself is to harm Rand. Grendel had previously insisted that Sindane is too weak to be Lanfear, but Arengar is sure that she is. Moradin then orders them to kill Matt and Perrin as a high priority and shows them images of the 2 boys, saying that they will be easy to find because they are Tavirin. Grendel says that finding Tavirin was never that simple, and it's now harder than ever with the whole pattern in flux. This is the first time Semirog has seen the faces of Matt and Perrin, and she complains to Moradin that it would have saved time had they known this earlier. Arengar has no problem killing the 2 boys if she runs into them, but she thinks that Moradin will be very disappointed over Rand, because clearly she intends to do something to him herself. So, that was a rather long introduction or summary there, but...
We actually get another recap of our favorite Forsaken Tea Party!
I love Forsaken Tea Parties. They're some of my favorites.
I like the Dark Friend gap.
Well, you would.
Nah, the Forsaken Tea Party is always a little struggle between everybody. The Dark Friends is always just one of those who can, you know, look the biggest and be the biggest wimp out of all of them.
We actually did kind of talk about this episode earlier, but I'm not sure that, you know, hidden Dark Friends or Dark Friend clues from the Dark Friends is actually going to see the light of day. We've sort of superseded it with this.
True. So, I did like the comment that you had made in your notes, asking how Arengar, then Balthamel, managed to cheat so much at the Sinji wheels, because obviously any place that caters to channelers through gambling has to have some sort of safeguards against tampering with the One Power.
Yeah, that struck me immediately. I was very curious as to how he managed to do that. He did say it was difficult, but he managed to win enough to impress a beautiful woman, and I thought, well, that's got to be a pretty neat trick.
Well, it was weird because he said, if I remember the quote properly, and I confess my book is not within arm's reach of me, it was something like, it was difficult to cheat enough to win. As like, there were different levels that you could cheat at, and that you had to find that right balance, otherwise you were likely to get caught or something.
Yeah, that is funny, actually. It's not that easy to cheat at gambling, even in this day and age, with the modern technology that casinos employ. I can't imagine that a Chandler would have much better luck at it, even in the Age of Legends.
What about inverting the weaves?
Yeah, well, surely that they have... they've already discovered some ways of detecting, men channeling and women channeling and everything. I'm sure that in the Age of Legends they must have had some way to detect inverted weaves.
Or even just warding the, wheel against, tampering with the one power.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. I don't know. Let's see, here's the section here. Not that it really matters much. Yeah, here it is. It had almost always been possible to impress a beautiful woman with large winnings at the Shinji wheels, though cheating enough to win consistently had been difficult, but necessary for a scholar who lacked wealth. All gone in ruins by the third year of the war. That must have been some long and bitter war. Good grief, can you imagine? That was almost as hard on everybody as the breaking.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, and also just the entire, when you read through the history and actually get a hold of, when each of the Forsaken ended up joining. I mean, it wasn't just like this mass, oh, hey, these 13-plus people just went directly over. I mean, they really are staggered as to when they came in. And, I think that probably has something to do with the various interplay between them as well.
You mean they didn't just all jump up and sing, let's all go to the dark one, let's all go to the dark one? No, I don't think they did that. I think you're probably right. They trickled in dribs and drabs as they individually went over their limit as to what they could tolerate and just decided to give it up and go to the dark one. So what I want to know is what and where did these Murdral and Trollocs that supposedly Samael ordered, where did they go and where did they end up? What attack was this? Is this the long time ago attack on the Two Rivers? Or is he referring to the build-up to the assault on the manor house later on in Knife of Dreams, where Rand and Loghain and Loial and the Aes Sedai and the Ashaman and everything managed to beat off literally thousands and thousands of Trollocs?
I think it's the manor house. If it's not, then it's probably something that's going to come up in the next book.
Yeah, I have to agree. Especially because I noted in the summary that Moradin ordered them to report any sign of Trollocs or Murdral outside of the Blight. And, if he still doesn't know where they are, then it kind of seems likely that he's going to, or that they're currently traveling to where they're going to assault Rand at the manor house.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I suspect it was the assault on the manor house as well. Is it Lord Agarin or something like that, his manor? Anyway, it surprises me that if a Shamael can find Tavirin as easily as he can find that, he can't find Shadowspawn the same way. It seems like there'd be some way he could do that if he was as powerful as he used to be.
Do you think he sent the Shadowspawn to begin with and it's just cleverly, covering his tracks?
Could be, but I sort of thought he tripped up Demandred with that. I thought Demandred acted a little bit odd there, too.
Well, and, the other thing was that Jordan did tell us that, Samael is toast. We've gotten that firm, word from the actual creator that, Samael's gone, he's not coming back. So it does bring up the question, who would give the orders in Samael's name? I mean, does this person know that Samael's not coming back? And if they do know this, how do they know this? You made a note earlier, Virginia, is wondering who's playing Arangar's game, where disguising themselves as other Forsaken, even, it kind of plays into the idea also, who else is Arangar imitating?
Exactly. That's kind of scary when you think about it. It could be any number of people. There are a number of incidences in I had really forgotten about this. There are a number of incidences in Saladar, or in the rebel camp, I should say, where somebody mentions that they don't know where Halima is. You know, she's doing something. It could very well be that she's, you know, impersonating somebody else briefly along enough to further some plot or another.
Well, what kind of interests me about the teaming up of this is that someone impersonated Samael to give the orders to send the Trollocs, you know, herring off on whatever attack they're off on. And Arengar wonders who's playing her game, meaning imitating other Forsaken. So who is Arengar imitating if someone impersonating Samael and giving orders is her game?
Exactly. That's what I'm wondering, too. I confess I'm stumped on that one. I mean, there's so many possibilities. Well, we know that Grendel is masquerading herself as various different people, including the Damani, you know, bloodborn, the elderly woman who was, you know, basically in a sick bed or whatever. She impersonates her to a number of people, but we don't have any clue that she's impersonating any of the other Forsaken. But you're right, it does sound very much like Arengar is impersonating other Forsaken.
Well, and here's the other thing, and when we see in the prologue Semirog showing up, and I think I mentioned this during our coverage of the prologue, it seemed to me a little bit like, in my mind, Semirog is so much creepier than the person claiming to be Semirog is. You know, there's a little quick blurb about the flaying a person alive as punishment or an apology is crude but inventive, which sort of sounds like Semirog, but for some reason I imagine her as being so much more calculating and, you know, mad doctorish kind of evil, that I just, something about the way her portrayal just didn't strike me as being Semiragi enough. So, you know, I'm kind of wondering if maybe someone didn't impersonate Semirog for that meeting, and in which case might actually even prove that Semirog wasn't the one who actually took out the royal or the imperial family.
Well, that's an interesting thought. So you think that the Semirog that was impersonating Tuon was the real Semirog, but the one that appeared to Suroth might not have been?
Quite possibly. Now,
wait a minute, she didn't even impersonate anybody. She appeared to Suroth as a clothed in flame, sort of the opposite of Nisana's, you know, silver and shadow disguise.
Yeah, the only thing that I see that pokes a hole in that concept is wanting Tuon out of the way was an easy way for her posing as Tuon later in the book would ensure that the real Tuon wouldn't show up somehow unexpectedly and, you know, disprove her imitation of Tuon.
Well, I never really got the point of her apparently going around masquerading as Tuon, extorting jewels and gold from various different nobles and merchants and so forth under the guise of being the daughter of the Nine Moons. That always struck me as a little odd. I suppose she was just trying to set her up to be killed because of the shame that she brought to the Imperial House for supposedly doing this, but that seemed like kind of a stretch to me.
Could not be her to begin with.
We have a third person, another person imitating Tuon?
I don't know. Like we said, it could have been Arengar impersonating Semirog, impersonating Tuon. That's even worse.
Now you're giving me a headache. This is like time travel. It gives me a headache.
Yeah, I mean that, or I there has been a theory put forth by one of the listeners that suggested that maybe the events to the south, of which Damandred is supposedly possibly responsible for, might in fact deal with either or both the Shanshan and the Children of the Light. And there is the extremely improbable idea that it could have been Damandred posing as Semirog, posing as Tuon.
That really does give me a headache. This whole series is convoluted enough without resorting to that, don't you think? Actually, I want to give credit to the listener, though, and it was actually a really good email and a fairly long and involved one, and this was from Simon from Brisbane, Australia. And actually, we've touched on it here, but I think that he brings up enough points that it might be worth considerably more discussion, you know, in another episode. But I do want to give credit where credit was due. That was one of our listener emails. Events to the South.
Yes, I definitely think that we will return to Simon's email. And it was a very, very good and well-thought set of theories that possibly disproved one of my earlier assumptions about where Demandred was and what he was doing. So definitely kudos.
Yeah, I do have to agree with one thing that he said, which was that when Salmiel referred to events to the south, he was speaking of events to the south of where he was at the time meeting Grendel in Aradoma, not events to the south when he was in Ilion, because events to the south from Ilion basically leaves what, the ocean and the Isle of Mad Men. That's about it. So I think he brought up a really good point there. It's probably, you know, somewhere to the south of Aradoman. And I think that's interesting that
so,
suddenly we're now all centering around going to Aradoman. You know, Rand's headed there with Loghain and the Sea Folk, and all these other people are headed here, there, and everywhere. But it's all centering now on Aradoman. So what's going to happen there? I mean, that's nowhere near Shael Ghul.
Well, I've been thinking about that a little bit, and I don't wonder if possibly the place where they talk about the boar wasn't actually drilled at Shael Ghul. That you know, the physical location is actually really, really different, and I don't remember which of the Forsaken muses upon that, but I'm not wondering if that's not something similar that, you know, everyone assumes because the prophecies of the dragon say, you know, his blood on the slopes of Shael Ghul, you know, they assume that it has to take place at Shael Ghul. But, you know, I don't know if maybe the pattern is just wonky enough or in enough a state of flux, as they are fond of claiming, that, you know, it might not, the last battle might end up happening someplace else. You know, where we completely wouldn't expect it. Sort of that, oh, you thought this was the build-up. No, this is actually the last battle now.
Well, it's possible. Anything is certainly possible. But I think that would really, after all these books of going on and on about the prophecies and everything, I think that would really throw a ringer in to make the last battle be somewhere else. Maybe a decisive battle leading up to it. But I can't think that the entire last battle would take place anywhere but somewhere near Shael Ghul. I don't know.
Could Shael Ghul be moving itself? Like how quarter shift in a, you know, Elaine's palace?
That's scary.
Because that would also help explain some of the shiftings with just locations, people getting confused on where they're going. It's like, maybe his plan is to move cities or his, you know, stronghold somewhere else, so it's not everybody focuses to go there, and all of a sudden, it's, you know, they're standing at Tarvalen for some reason.
Woo, so Shael Ghul, the original Hellmoth, coming to a backyard near you.
He's franchising.
Ow, that's even scarier. You really are a dark friend, Morgan. You really are. You know too much. I suppose if he can move corridors and streets and all this other stuff, he can eventually move cities. I don't really know what's up with that anyway, that shifting, and it just makes no sense to me, because it was even brought up, well, what if you wake up in a room that suddenly has no exit anymore, or what if you're in a corridor that has just suddenly disappeared? You know, what happens? It just seems too random for that sort of thing not to be happening. I don't know why more people haven't just gone missing than things just disappeared. I mean, of course, the first thing it makes me think of is the scene in Harry Potter where all the stairs are shifting around and like that, but I mean, no matter how good you are at twisting reality around, you can't just rearrange palace corridors and have them all meet up so that people get lost. I don't understand how even the Dark One could do that.
Probably the same way he can bring people back to life.
I guess. Well, they did say reality is clay to the Dark One, at least close to Shael Ghul. It could be that way anywhere else, but that creeps me out even more than villages disappearing.
Maybe this whole thing, you know, villages appearing, ghost walking around, corridor shifting is nothing more than just a major psychological warfare. Just if everybody's freaked out about, you know, not knowing what's going to happen, then it's just easier to overrun, cut them down.
They did say the Dark One hadn't played all of his cards yet. Actually, I think it was more of a boxing reference, but, you know, still the same idea that, you know, we haven't even seen the Dark One's best moves yet.
Yeah, he hasn't seen his stuff yet. Well, speaking of the Dark One, what about those seals? He gave one. Where are they? I mean, Moradin's looking for them. He wants them found. He wants them found right now. And that's it. Go get them. Right now. And we think that Rand gave one to Bashir. Or did he? You think he gave them all to Bashir? Do you think other people have them? Maybe Dobraine, I guess, was attacked. They were looking for them in Dobraine's quarters. I don't know who he really gave them to, or if they took them and hid them, or... And that would only be two of the three. I don't know. I can't even guess what Rand would have been up to with that one. I mean, he can travel anywhere. He can pretty much dump them any place.
I was going to say, did he even give them to anybody? I don't think there's been, like, any reference to him in his own mind saying, you know, uh-oh, bad choice in giving it to this person or that. I think he might have just, like, the whole Chodin call and just, you know, went wherever he wanted to or was, you know, familiar with and just threw it in a hole and weaved it up.
He could have, but I do seem to recall the scene where Mazrim Taim brought him one of the seals, and we had the whole thing where Rand, you know, raises it over his head and he's talking about break him, break him, break him, break him. He's like freaking out. And then he, as I recall, he turns around and he hands it to Bashir, and Bashir says something very formal. This will be, we'll keep this safe until you require it, whether it be 10 days or 10 years, something to that effect. So I think he did give Bashir one. I don't know about the other. If he actually gave it to Dobraine, that was a good guess, probably for whoever was looking for them. But I can't guess who else might even have the third one. Maybe he gave one to Varen. Maybe that's why she rode off.
Apparently, according to the 13th repository, all of the whole seals, at least through the beginning of Knife of Dreams, were in Rand's possession, one of which was with Dovrum, one of which was with Dobraine. Between those two, the third either Rand is supposedly keeping on his own, or he, once again, yes, he's given it to some other person that hasn't been named yet.
Well, I thought it extremely interesting that later in the book that Varen takes off when she does. I know we're getting a little ahead of ourselves with that on that one, or I am getting ahead of ourselves. You know, of course, we have two theories on that that I know of, many probably others that I don't know of. But one was that she decided to take off and find the Horn of Valyr because Matt will need that at some point in time, because he's the only one that can sound it. Now that he's sounded it once, he has to either... It's no good to anybody else unless he dies, and then anyone else can use it. And maybe he decided that it was too dangerous for him to keep the seal and gave it to her for safekeeping, and she decided she better get it out of the near vicinity of the Dragon Reborn. That idea just popped into my head a minute ago, so I haven't really formalized that crazy theory. But what made her just jump up and take off? I mean, like I say, we are getting ahead of ourselves.
Isn't there a Dark Friend theory that was floating around that was something like, you know, why she left?
Probably. My thought was really on where are the seals that Moradin is now searching for. That's what ties this back into this particular chapter.
Well, for some reason, despite the failed attempts to take the seals from Dobraine and Dovrum, I do think they probably still have each of those two in their possession, assuming that the act of giving them the seals wasn't done on purpose to lead people astray.
Well, it sure paints a big bullseye on whoever he gives it to. It's a big target there.
I mean, I do think it's dubious that Rand would keep all three or even one of them in his possession, knowing in his mind that he has a increasing urge to break them.
Yeah, that kind of worries me too.
It's kind of like leaving an open bottle of Jack Daniels in a room with an alcoholic.
Yeah. So I guess the question would be, who has he been with since he gave the two seals, one to Dovrum, we presume, and one to Dobraine? Who does he trust enough that is not with him all the time already? Darlin, perhaps? Darlin Cisnero? In Tyr?
Definitely possible.
And he was certainly there. I mean, my other two picks for somebody that he trusts to give them to are with him now, so that kind of blows that, and that would be Cad Swain and Viren, although Viren has now gone off, taken Thomas and gone off to be about serving him in the best way she knows how. Maybe he finally broke down and gave her the last seal. He really didn't seem very upset about her leaving.
That's true. I could also have seen him giving it to Cad Swain, if for no other reason than I'm fairly certain she still has the access, or the one whole access key for the male Choden call with her. I don't think we ever saw that going back to Rand at any point in time after he used it to cleanse the source.
No, I don't recall that either. The only thing I would have to say against that theory is that it doesn't really help having this. Well, I mean, he obviously won't have immediate access to the seal to break it, but it doesn't really help it to be that close to him if he gives it to her, because she's now his advisor and hanging out with him. So that's not going to take it away from him unless perhaps he gave it to Cad Swain and Cad Swain gave it to Viren.
Possible. I mean, I do also think that Cad Swain also would be a logical choice, because while her being in proximity to Rand is, you know, a slight danger, I also think that the chances of Cad Swain yielding up the seal to Rand, even if he asked politely, is probably slim to none if she doesn't think it's a good idea.
Oh, I don't think she'd give it to the Dark One himself if he appeared in a column of smoke and shadow and said, "Give me that." She'd probably fight him over it.
I think she would have mentioned it in one of her points of views, so I don't think she has it. It's a good theory about it being with her, just so Rand could have it near him and out of harm's way from himself, but I just think she'd have that little feather in her cap in one of her points of views where she has to deal with that.
You could have given it to Nynaeve if you trust her.
Bella has it.
It surprises me a little bit at how long it has taken all of the Forsaken who are currently still alive to become informed of who Matt and Perrin are.
I know, none of them were evidently at that wonderful Dark Friend meeting where we met Bors and Balzamon, who is, we believe, now also Ishalmiel, who was also Moradin, showed them the figures of the three boys. And that's a good point, because that's obviously pretty funny when you look back at it, that Semirog had Matt basically right under her feet all the time in Evodar, and she didn't know who he was. She never made the connection between Tylan's toy and the Tavirin Matt. So apparently it isn't all that easy to find Tavirin if you've got one, you know, romping around the same palace with you and can't tell.
Well, I kind of think that Moradin might not have that talent that allows you to see Tavirin, because Ishi really latched on to all three boys the moment he came into contact with them. And, you know, even early on, it seems like, you know, he devoted a lot of attention to the three of them and was able to find them really easy through the dreams and whatnot, even though, you know, that apparently locating people in dreams, even if you're a dreamer, isn't the most easy thing in the world. So now that I think about it, if you're a dreamer or have really good control in Teleron Riad, you should actually be able to find people's dreams relatively easily. Because I think Egwene mentions that at some point in time. But I mean, it is one of those things that he seems to be able to find them really easily. And when, you know, one of them mentions in this tea party that it wasn't as easy as you always said it was, it makes me think that maybe, like the one girl in the Saladar camp, that he might not have that ability to see Tavirin, and that might be his way of finding them as easily as he has.
Well, either that, or that was in the earlier books that he had basically no trouble going to Rand, Perrin, and Matt in their dreams. But since then, a lot of things have happened to them. Rand now can channel the One Power and knows how to ward his dreams. Egwene specifically mentions that he wards his dreams like the Aes Sedai do. And presumably that would make it harder to find him. Perrin has his own sort of protection because of the wolves. The the wolf dream apparently protects him from being found a little bit, and Matt, maybe his Tarangriel has something to do with that too, and it makes him harder to find. There's no way to really know.
Well, he also kind of seemed to lose interest in the three boys once it became really obvious that no amount of bothering them in their dreams was going to get them to willingly come over to the Dark One.
Yeah, and I think he also lost a little bit of interest once he realized that Rand was the one. The other two basically became... He sort of dismissed them, I think, the same way that Moraine did in the beginning, you know, that the idea of having three Taverin all together was really, really significant. I think he just kind of blew them off.
He blows them off and then he dies pretty recently to that, doesn't he? So maybe it's not just the whole dream thing. I was thinking it was, he might have, like, a network of, you know, carrion eaters and mice, just, you know, reporting back to him about any strange things going on in, you know, towns, stuff like that.
Well, and we kind of, you know, forget the fact that being Nablus basically means that he's the Dark Lord's regent on Earth. So it may be that he has now had a little sharp reminder of his own from the Dark One, say, hey, you know, you need to round up these other two Taverin, they're significant. Get on it.
Here's a quick question. Do you think there's anything more than Nablus than just, oh, you're a, you know, channeler for the dark side who's just better than everybody else? Do you think he's embedding him, you know, embedding the Nablus with himself, maybe? Or it's setting them up so that he can be clothed in, you know, the flesh of a man as opposed to a Murdral?
Well, I've always thought that Nablus was basically the Dark One's champion, like Rand is the champion of the light. They've mentioned, you know, referenced that several times. I think the Shaedar Haran thing is a separate issue, a way for you know, the Dark One to interact with the world while he's still sealed up. I don't think that he's going to be bothering with that Murdral guise once he actually breaks free, if he ever does. And I just have always assumed that the Nablus was the being geared up to be the Dark One's champion, and that they would actually do the fighting.
There was also a crazy theory that was brought up quite a bit earlier in a podcast. I do not know if it has been released yet or not, wherein the champion of the light, Rand in this case, and the champion of the Dark One, presumably Moradin, would end up becoming something like avatars of the respected, you know, creator and Dark One, so much so that when the wheel turns into subsequent ages, what is left of them spirit-wise would become new representations of what the Creator and the Dark One are, so that each time the champions don't actually go into the cycle of rebirth, but become the next Creator and Dark One to start the cycle over again, which is why the wheel has repeated so many times, as opposed to just, you know, the same omnipresent good and evil force that constantly reenact the same battle over and over again.
I don't know. That's too esoteric for me. I get a little bit annoyed with the whole idea of the whole cycle repeating itself over and over again. It seems like, you know, the Creator could have come up with a little bit more variety rather than just repeating the same cycle throughout eternity. I don't know the point.
If you think about it, and like I said, this is purely hypothetical, if during each set of seven ages a new Creator and Dark One emerge, then it would be their impetus as the new omnipresent all-powerful forces to try to fix what they saw as being wrong with their iteration of life within the wheel, and therefore would try again to do what the previous Creator and Dark One did, thereby possibly falling into the same mistakes and essentially repeating the same pattern by trying to not repeat the same pattern.
Yeah, right. By actually, it's sort of like quantum theory, you know, by as soon as you look at something, it's not the same anymore because you changed it, because you looked at it, you know. Like, they try to change it, and as soon as they try to change it, they make it more the same.
Darn you, Schrodinger and your hypothetical cat.
Oh, too funny. I love Schrodinger. Well, let's see. We talked about Erengar having her own plans concerning Rand and Warden, but I think it's pretty obvious it seems that she has her own plans and the other Forsaken do as well, so we can probably just kind of run past that. And unless you have any other thoughts on this particular chapter, I think we're almost ready for the next one.
Yes, so Chapter 4 is entirely from Perrin's point of view. Perrin goes to a meeting with the Seanchan, mediated by Talonvor. He, Galen, Berlaine, Honora, Jur Grady, Gerard, Arganda, and a host of soldiers wait for the Seanchan delegation. Berlaine is still angry at Honora, that Honora met with Massima behind her back. Aram says that the Prophet thinks the meeting is a trap, but Perrin is, of course, prepared. Balwer has reported to Perrin that Aram is spending a lot of time with Massima. Perrin, briefly, during the wait, thinks about Matt and sees a swirl of colors, which resolves into Matt talking with a small dark woman, we will later find out to be Tuan. The Seanchan arrive, accompanied by Talonvor. There's a Saldam and a Damane with them. The two Seanchan leaders are Captain Bakayar Mishima and Banner General Tylee Kiergan. Noting Perrin's eyes and hammer, Tylee cites the prophecies of the dragon from Seanchan about Tarmogaidon, when the Wolf King carries the hammer, thus the final days are known, when the fox marries the raven, the trumpets of battle are blown. Perrin thinks that Hopper would probably laugh at the Wolf King comment, but is surprised to find out that he's mentioned in the prophecies. Tylee notes that Berlaine's name is Paindrag. She is descended, of course, from Arthur Paindrag Terranol. Berlaine claims only Maine, but she says she will defend it proudly. To show the prowess of his men, Perrin raises a flat branch into the air. From the woods, 300 paces away, Jondan Baron and Jory Conger shoot arrows into it. Then Jur Grady raises it into the air and flash burns it. The Damane Nori puts out the small grass fire, and the Saldam reports that it was indeed a man channeling who did the burning of the branch. Todd hands Perrin the Manethrin banner, and he offers it to Tylee, saying he will relinquish all claim of restoring Manethrin in Emmons Field and the Two Rivers if she helps him free Fael. At that moment, a sulfurous gale blows through, the same wind that we got from the very beginning of the prologue. It blows through and it startles everybody. Perrin tells Tylee that Sivana and the Shido have 300 or 400 wise ones channeling. Tylee does not have the resources to face so many, and she tells Perrin that. She says that she would have to disturb the Daughter of the Nine Moons and possibly apologize to the Empress, as we all know how deadly that can be. Perrin heard that the Seanchan have something that knocks out channelers. He plans to put this compound, Forkroot Tea, in the Shido's water supply. Tylee says that there is a manufactory, almost to Taraban, but she doesn't have enough political weight to get enough of the tea. Perrin says that they can travel, which covers the distance problem very easily, and shows Tylee and Mishima an order from High Lady Sarath. Tylee is thoroughly impressed by this and wants to know who Perrin really is. To which he responds, he is a man who wants his wife back and will deal with the Dark One to get her. And he and the Seanchan conclude their deal.
Okay, I love it that she says that. And as soon as she said that, who are you? I was reminded of Fael going, who are you, farm boy?
Perrin, wolf brother of mystery.
That's right. Who are you, farm boy? The dragon reborn? Pretty funny. So, I think it's interesting that they brought the wind through again. We see this wind appearing a lot in this particular book, and it just doesn't ever seem to really, you know, just go away in the prologue as we're used to, or the first chapter.
Could it be the metaphoric trumpets blowing for the last battle due to the later marrying of Tuon, and then Perrin with the hammer?
I don't know. Do we need any more harbingers of the last battle? We've got the dead walking, Sidar and Sidene acting weird and failing, cities appearing out of nowhere and disappearing, and reality rippling. I mean, do we need anything else to list? Hello?
Wasn't Rand, like, spent up to, I think, was it book 4? Book 6, I think, is at the end of Buck 6, it's finally one of those things where it's just like, I've shown you who I am so many times, and, you know, I've gone through this, you know, again and again and again. Now listen to me, and that's the turning point when he finally listens to it. So I think the, you know, general population of Ranland kind of needs as many flags saying, hey, boat's going this way, let's try to, you know, get a hold of it.
That could be. I have to switch gears a little bit for a second, and I like your comment, Andrew, that the most significant thing in this chapter is that Perrin finally learns that he's mentioned in the prophecies. He never knew that, and I think that's kind of odd. Actually, we never knew that either. As many times as those prophecies of the dragon have been quoted to us, read by Rand in his point of view, and etc., nothing ever mentioned the Wolf King, the hammer, or any of that stuff, and that certainly would have rung a lot of alarm bells. I wonder why nobody mentioned it before now.
Yeah, I mean, not only that, but Matt, too, you know, with the fox marrying the raven, and, you know, it just, it seems really interesting that they're the prophecies of the dragon, not the prophecies of the dragon and his buddies.
Yeah, but they're there. I didn't know that either until you're right. Matt, the fox that makes the ravens fly, and then the battle of, what was the last line? The trumpets.
The entire prophecies is when the Wolf King carries the hammer, thus are the final days known, when the fox marries the raven and the trumpets of battle are blown.
Yeah, I presume that the trumpets of battle refer to the Horn of Valyr, because obviously the fox, Matt, you know, blew that, and then he ends up marrying the Imperial Raven, Tuon. That's all just beyond creepy. I mean, I wonder why Rand never picks up on that when he's, you know, poring over these multiple translations of the prophecies in the Stone of Tyr and so forth.
Hey, I just found an interesting prophecy from The Great Hunt, Chapter 8. When the winds of Tarmon Gaiden scour the earth, he shall face the shadow and bring forth the light into the world again. Could that just be Robert Jordan quickly finishing a prophecy he brought in?
It could be. We certainly got the winds scouring the earth a lot more in this chapter. The winds are doing unnatural things, you know, like blowing the sulfur smell such a long way. And in later chapters, we have them, you know, the winds blowing against one another. We got leaves going from one direction and the other direction. We got winds blowing across the water in the opposite direction of where they should be, and mists blowing across the water with the sea folk, you know, in opposition to the direction of the wind. I mean, all these strange things are happening. So the whole, all of reality basically just seems to be breaking down. But do you really think that this alliance with Perrin is actually, I mean, he keeps talking about he'll make an alliance with the Dark One, and he really sees the Shan Chan as being almost the Dark One, but then they turn out to be kind of good guys. I mean, do you really think that this is actually an alliance with the Dark One, that it's not furthering the cause of the light?
I think it's going to hinder it with what happens later in the book, but I don't think so. I think it's just the whole raven being the imperial symbol from, I believe, the Shamael, you know, corrupting the country of Shan Chan. That's made him think that he's doing nothing but dealing with the Dark One, since they're coming back and attacking and everything.
This is true. I did have a point between Perrin and the Shan Chan that I would like to make a clarification on an earlier statement I made during our geopolitical discussion. During that episode, I put forth the idea that Perrin was giving the Shan Chan Manethrin. This has been horribly, horribly misinterpreted by a great number of people, and I would like to try to clarify what I was actually meaning at the time when I made that comment. No, Perrin obviously only gives up the right to raise Manethrin himself. My statement was that from the Shan Chan point of view, that action would entitle them to then raise Manethrin for the Empire themselves. In effect, they would see it as him giving them Manethrin, even though he did not actually do so, nor did he intend to do so. I think it's more an idea that to the Shan Chan, the act of giving up the ability to raise Manethrin is akin to giving them the rights to the land, or giving them the rights to, like I said, raise it themselves. And with as possessive as the Shanshan are about the ancestral homeland that they are now coming back to reclaim, that it is a very easy leap to go from, well, he says he's not going to raise Manetherin against us, to, well, he gave us what was Manetherin, so we might as well take it because we need to take it anyway because it is ours by right anyway. So I honestly didn't mean that Perrin was like, here, take this land. I more meant that based on what I assume the Shanshan mentality to be, that they will probably see this gesture in a different light than Perrin intended it, and that if this issue isn't addressed, that it could cause further problems later in the series when Rand is trying to make an alliance with the Shanshan, while at the same time they are possibly trying to claim Manetherin based on what Perrin has already done. And obviously, to win the last battle, Rand has to unite the North and the South and everything, and it seems really to point that Rand does have to make an alliance with the Shanshan if he is going to succeed.
Well, it's so easy to misspeak, especially since, you know, we basically do this podcast without a script. We discuss these books just the way, you know, a lot of friends would sit down and discuss the books, and we don't have stacks of reference notes in front of us, and we don't exactly know where the conversation's going to go when we start out. So if we do occasionally misspeak, you know, we hope that you'll be patient with us. You know, we're working without a net here.
True. And like I said, I admit my original comment was not clearly stated enough to mean what I actually meant to say. So I do want to apologize to everyone who misinterpreted what I said because I was not clear enough.
Well, that's fine. We'll just move on because these things happen. And hopefully everybody will understand. Going on to the next note that you have here, I'm not sure about this. Cirith making comment, even via letter with Perrin, is probably the smartest thing she ever did as a Dark Friend, but unfortunately, she didn't intend to do that.
No, I totally agree.
That was kind of tongue-in-cheek. It was the smartest thing she ever did as a Dark Friend. She just didn't know she was doing it. And that letter sure made the rounds, though. I mean, it went from Massima to Berylaine's Thief Takers to Perrin, and you know, it's like, wow, you know, that's a pretty popular little piece of paper. You'd think that they'd have some sort of a limit or date or, you know, this offer good through.
Maybe they should have pheasant grease claws in it?
Yeah, exactly. He had it like all folded up in his gauntlet, and he got the wood hen grease all over it from the little basket of food that Berylaine bought him. It's like, oh, man.
You think somebody would just go, this letter smells like an armpit. What did you do with it?
All right, who did you kill to get this letter?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, I mean, that's kind of a dangerous thing to have just a carte blanche letter like that. That's even more than, you know, Swan giving the girls these letters of rights, you know. At least that was for a finite sum of money. This is basically just open-ended and unending and, yeah, I don't know. The whole thing is pretty stupid to me. But, hey, it works.
Easier to spread chaos if you make it vague.
Don't think that was her intent when she did that, but maybe it was. I don't know. I'm not a Dark Friend, so it's hard for me to see all the plots. And then, moving on from that, Andrew, I really like your next comment.
Oh, yes. Poison the water. I like it. Honestly, it is a brilliant, brilliant strategy on Perrin's part to have noted how the water comes into the camp. He was very, very interested in the prologue when Galena mentions that the Wise Ones only drink water. And it just seems like the target delivery system to be able to put out the channelers if he can get enough fork root is, you know, exactly what he needed. And it, you know, Taverin pulling definitely did its job, but Perrin definitely had to have that idea snap into his head that, hey, this is our strategy. We know they only drink water. They're the only ones who can channel. we put this stuff that knocks him out into the water supply, it follows down. I mean, it tactically, it's a wonderfully brilliant move. And, yeah, honestly, Perrin gets a thumbs up in my book for that one.
Yeah, I have to agree. That was really brilliant. You know, some of the... that goes on beyond being Tavira, and that's just plain old good... That's like Matt strategy.
And he was barely whiny at all while he was doing it.
I know! That's the amazing part, isn't it? He was hardly whining a bit. We went through whole chapters where Perrin hardly whined at all. It was like, oh, wow, he's almost back to normal. You know, in one respect, Fayil was the best thing that ever happened to him. In another respect, she's one of the worst things that happened to him. He's ready to make a deal with the Dark One. You know, he's ready to give up everything, let the world burn as long as he can get Fayil back. And then, totally against his character, he spends book after book whining and moaning and bellyaching about how he's, you know, got to be the hammer and the anvil. And, oh, I wanted to just hit myself in the head with a hammer during some of those scenes. It's just hard to read through after a couple of times, too. But that's done now, so we don't have to worry about it anymore. He got her back. Yay!
You know, along with this, too, this is the first time we get to meet Ty Lee and Mishima. And honestly, I don't really care about Mishima one way or the other. He can totally die for all I care. But I really like Ty Lee. She seems a bit more flexible other Shanshan that I've seen, you know, while still falling within all the proper Shanshan militaristic protocols and everything. She seems, at least in my mind, from what we've seen of her in this book, to be someone who understands what an alliance like this with someone who is connected to the Dragon Reborn could mean for the Empire. And she's doing her best to do what's right for her people. But at the same time, you know, we've seen a few of the Shanshan military people, and they're really just stuffy and kind of hard to read just for the fact that they are so, you know, I am military and I will think this way and we are Borg, all your, you know, basically just really robotic in their way. And I like Ty Lee because she seems like some of the other Shanshan military that we've seen, to really think on her feet and really be aware of what's going on around her. And she seems to make a really nice character in my mind.
Well, I agree and disagree with you a little bit. I think that she does make a really nice character, and I liked her a lot. And I didn't think that she was that different from some of the others that we have seen. We obviously have seen a lot of the rigid ones that you describe, certainly. But she reminds me a lot of Egyanen, who is now Lyalan shipless, because they share a lot of personality traits in common. I think the big difference is that Egyanen has been under incredible stress almost since the first time we met her, and I don't think that she's ever, up until recently, I don't think we've ever really seen much of the human side of her, although clearly Bail Doman saw it enough to marry her. I love Matt's point of view comment about that. It's like he sat there wondering how insane Bail Doman had to be to marry this woman long enough that he didn't respond with congratulations to their announcement of being married, to the point that he thought that Bail was getting pretty mad at him. Poor Matt. He's all over Bail Doman for marrying Lawen, and look at the hard ass he married.
Yeah, no, and I agree that Ty Lee is very much like Lawen, the way they adapted and yet have maintained their individual ethnic identity while being adaptive to Randland.
Yeah, it's kind of funny because Robert Jordan apparently modeled their accents on the Texans, and while the Shanshan culture is really nothing like that of any part of Texas, there is a certain element, I think, if you could get the Shanshan, you know, off duty, if you will, you know, maybe on their own, just kind of relaxing and everything. I see a lot of the good old boy in some of them, you know. Maybe I'm off base with that, but they seem like a lot more likable characters than I would have ever believed possible when they were first introduced as basically just villains.
Yeah. My favorite one was the Skyrider. I can't remember what they were. The Toe Rockin' Rider. Anybody remember what they're called?
The Morot Toe Rockin'.
Yeah, the one who's surveying a farmhouse being taken captured with all the kin in it, who's just flying around. He's like, you know, when we get done with this, I'm just going to, you know, spend all my money, buy a tavern, get, you know, Suldam and Damani that I could just make night flowers with. I have to say that's the only one that I actually really favor more than, oh, it's just Sean Chan.
They were kind of likable and nice, and that was the whole point.
So, following the chapter 4, which was entitled A Deal, we have chapter 5, Something Strange. Or rather, Something Strange. The chapter is from Fael's point of view, which will of course make many, many people groan. It is early morning, nearly a month since Fael was caught with the knife, nearly 2 months since she was captured. She is one of a dozen Gai Shane serving in Sivana's tent. Bane and Chade have had an easy time being Gai Shane, of course, because they're Aiel and know what is expected. She thinks that Roland has probably saved her life. She has convinced herself she needs to escape before Perrin finds her, because he'll probably get himself killed. But they have been at Malden for such a long time that it's becoming a looming threat. Therava is there with Galena. Fael hopes that Galena isn't going to betray her. Chuckle. Fael fears betrayal, and she realizes she has to protect Aleandre and Megden, as well as herself. Savannah is speaking at length about how she is intent on marrying Rand to cement her relationship to the Karakarn, and, you know, deciding that the marriage will result in the Karakarn being a passable title like king or queen. Therava believes that Cooladin was the true Karakarn, and that Rand was a puppet set up by the Aes Sedai, that the Aes Sedai told him what to say at Al-Khayyar Dal, and since Sivana never went to Ruadin, she's pretty clueless about everything that Therava says. Therava tells Sivana that there are many Sept chiefs who are still trying to use their Narbaha. Fael returns to her tent after this particular comment. There are 14 Septs around Malden, and two more, the Morai and the White Cliffs, just days away. On the way to the tent, she runs into Mira. Mira and Rahael debrief the Gai Shane after they attend Sivana. Without any warning at all, three ripples pass through reality itself, in which, you know, Fael feels like she's literally, you know, being torn apart, and that just everything in reality seems to change and shake, and it's very traumatizing. Fael and Mira are both horribly shocked by the event. Fael returns to the tent that she shares with Aleandre, Megden, and Durain. Durain is a spy for Sivana. Aleandre is recovering from a switching, which Fael reminds her that she dealt with Massima before all of this happened, so she should be able to keep her nerve up. Aravine arrives and reports that Alvin and his son Theral have something. Outside, Theral gives Fael the binding rod, which was stolen from Theravra's tent. Roland appears unexpectedly, and the other three leave at this point. He and the other Meridin plan to return to the Aiel Waste. The brotherless have finally decided to leave the Shido. He has figured out that Fael plans to escape. He tells her that when they go, Joradin plans to take Lasiel with him, and the maiden who captured Arella plans to take her. Roland wants to take Fael with him. He lets her go, and she hides the binder inside the town. But Fael still considers Roland's offer, wondering to herself if perhaps even one moment of infidelity buying her freedom could be worth Perrin not attacking and possibly getting himself killed. Later, Therivra discovers that the binder is missing and leads a furious search, but of course does not find it.
Yes, she runs around screaming, "There'll be hell to pay!" No, she doesn't really, but she might as well. Okay, the big thing in this chapter to me, other than the little byplay with Fael and Roland, is the ripples in reality. That is pretty serious stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I do kind of wonder, because as we mentioned earlier in the last chapter, there is the possibility that, you know, the ripples in reality are a sign that the last battle is coming. There's been, you know, a suggestion or put forth in this episode as well that it might be the Dark One's doing, that, you know, he might be able to influence the world enough now that he's able to shift reality around and just change how reality works, which is horribly unsettling. And then I believe that in an earlier episode, which may or may not have also been released, that we discussed the possibility that the ripples in reality might be a result of, or a repercussion of, rather, of the overabundant use of Balefire in this last year.
I really like that theory, because it just seems to work so well, because everyone's warning that the pattern almost came apart when they Balefired a whole city. And that just seems like that's what it almost does. You know, the ripple hit them, and it's like they were getting torn to pieces without actually being torn. I'm going with Balefire.
Well, I gotta disagree with you on that one. I like the idea, but I don't think that the amount of Balefire that's been used, at least of what we know of from the books, is anything approaching what was used in the Age of Legends during the War of Power, because it was said that whole cities died in Balefire. We've seen nothing on that scale. I mean, the only thing even approaching that amount of the power being used was the cleansing of Cydene, and that wasn't Balefire. Nothing has been destroyed except a couple of people, a few chunks of the palace here and there, and most of those episodes were actually in Telenriad. So how much does that affect the real world? Not at all. Or unless it's somehow more devastating if it happens in Telenriad, but I just don't think we've seen that level of Balefire. It's been pretty local and not, you know, took out a few Darkhounds, you know. I'm just not going to, no. I don't think, it may have contributed, but I don't think that's the cause.
Well, the only reason that I would suggest that it could possibly be a Balefire repercussion, and I'm not actually certain who advanced this theory to begin with. I'd have to go back and listen to the previous episodes again. But the idea might be that if the pattern almost came apart during the Age of Legends, that means the pattern is somewhat weak already, you know, unless there's some way to regain strength, you know, tensile strength in the pattern of the Wheel of Time over the course of time. But I don't, you know, exactly. So it might just be compounding the problem that was started during the Age of Legends by using even just this little bit more. Because, I mean, Moiraine, when Rand uses it to kill the Darkhounds with, Moiraine hauls off and hits him and says, "You are never to do that again." I mean, she seems really, really adamant. And if it weren't amazingly dangerous at that point in time to even be using any amount of Balefire, then, you know, I can't believe that her reaction would be quite as strong as it is. Now, like I said, I might be jumping at shadows here.
Yeah, but Moiraine used Balefire on Darkhounds back in, like, book one or two. I mean, she's the one who used it first.
True, but I also think that Moiraine has, when she has used it, she's used it very sparingly and only in what she seems, in my mind, of her point of view, to be like a last final recourse, where when she sees Rand doing it, you know, he's learned that they can be killed by this thing. He doesn't understand the thing, so he's just throwing it around, you know, and he even tells her, "Look, if using this is going to, you know, keep my friend Matt from dying, well then, you know, I'm going to use it." And, you know, it's just one of those contention points between the two of them that I think she's more cautious about it, even though, yes, she does use it. I don't think she would use it unless it was absolutely, in her mind, paramount and necessary.
Well, and the other key point here, I think, is to sort of defeat my own little premise there, is that the amount of power that Moraine can draw upon to use Balefire is a patch on what the Dragon Reborn can draw upon to do it. So, resulting from Balefire are going to probably be an order of magnitude less than the least of what Rand's throwing around.
Doesn't he throw, like, a big, like, heaping bar at the Darkhounds when she finds them? And she's been using a little trickle, like Virginia said?
Yeah, Rand even thinks to himself he was going to have to find his control of this weapon because he used too much.
Yeah, so then he uses, what is it? They describe it as like a finger or a pinky's width to kill the one that was tearing open the door.
Yeah, something like that.
Which is a good thing because, you know, if he'd been too much stronger in that, he would have blasted straight through the door and killed Matt, too.
No, because he did it at an angle because he knew that Matt was, you know, he might be behind the door. So he basically, they even describe it as he goes sort of to the side and gets the Dark Hounds without going through the door with the Balefire. Because he knew they were in the room.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, Rand's a little slow, but he's not completely stupid, you know. He has his moments of inspiration. He's not a hay hare all the time.
It's a wool head, isn't it?
Wool head, sheep herder, hay hare, all kinds of things that Min calls him. Well, anyway, I'm going to come down on the side of we haven't seen anything like approaching the amount of Balefire used in the books that we've seen so far to cause the pattern to ripple in that sort of effect. Unless that's just all it takes and that, you know, there's like a really short distance of between not enough to really affect it and enough to unravel the whole universe, and it doesn't seem too likely to me, but anything's possible. I kind of think it's the Dark One's touch on it. Supposedly he wants to, you know, kill the Wheel of Time and make reality over in his own image or whatever, so that might be one of the ways he's going about it.
I only thought it was that way because there's not a lot of Balefire being used, but it's also not like it's a big city, it's just a, you know, an encampment, a small little localized area is getting this little ripple. Nobody else has that problem.
Well, we just didn't have a point of view from anybody else in the world. I mean, it could have been the whole world that rippled like that. We don't know.
You'd think Perrin would say something like, holy crap, what's going on? And then cry for a chapter about his wife.
Yeah, true.
No, I also thought it was very interesting that there are references in here, not only just to the Meriden leaving, but, you know, also to the clan chiefs trying to use the fool boxes, the Narbaha, and just the idea that, you know, they kind of want to reopen gateways and go back to the Threefold Land. It seems like not a lot of people, or not a lot of the clan chiefs who are siding with the Shido really actually want to be there any longer. They're kind of like, yeah, this is great, but rather just kind of go back to the waste.
Well, I think they are Shido, and it's not like they don't want to, the Meriden don't want to be with the Shido anymore, but the Shido who are oppressing the Narbaha, they don't not want to be with the Shido. They just don't want to be there, away from the Threefold Land and being led by Savannah, who has, against all reason and rationality in my book, not only managed to get herself named an honorary wise one, has to be honorary because she never went to Rydian, but she gets the position of being the one who speaks for the clan chief whose widow she is. It's bizarre. It's sort of like, well, they do that in our world, too, when a senator dies or somebody from the House of Representatives, their wife or a friend or a staff worker or somebody can actually be appointed to fill their position temporarily. And we've had a number of people get into power that just exactly that way, sort of through the back door. But totally lost my train of thought there. But I think there's a real break in the Shido happening where a lot of them just don't want to be there. Because they did mention, Thrava did mention to Savannah that some of the clan chiefs, maybe, I've forgotten the fellow's name, one of the clan chiefs was sent to Rydian with a bunch of guards and four wise ones to go through the glass columns that Rand did and thus hopefully become a clan chief, which would basically knock Sivana out of her position as one who speaks for the clan chief, and they didn't bother to tell her about this until they were 3 days down the road, 3 or 4 days down the road, so she couldn't do a thing about it.
Well, that is true. I mean, Sivana is not the greatest of leaders. She seems to have survived a few horrible debacles, and yet still manages to find herself somewhat in charge, and, I mean, I'm surprised that the other wise ones didn't immediately go, you know what, it's been our tradition to send somebody to Ruidian to go through the thing so that we can have a clan chief. Why are we not doing this? And you know, it seems like they finally organized somebody to do this, but it seems a little late in the game for it.
Aren't they only scared because of, I think Thrava's in there with them, and the other wise ones pulling apart, one of the wise ones and framing up the Aes Sedai? That was, you know, that's the only reason why they're still listening to her? Is they're, you know, afraid that that'd be exposed and everybody would go and, rebel against them?
That is true. They got into that weird little arrangement about, you know, killing off the one wise one and, like, framing the Aes Sedai for it, which, you know, kind of smart in some ways, but, you know, once again, motivating people by blackmail that way is just a really good way to wind up with a knife in your back at some point.
Yeah, I never really understood that whole thing. I don't know why any wise one in their right mind would have gone along with that for a minute. I don't know why they would have gone along with the killing of Desaine, I think her name was. I don't know why they would have gone along with Sivana speaking for the clan chief. I don't know why they would have gone along with her being promoted to wise one without any training, no apprenticeship, no nothing. That whole thing was bizarre to me. I mean, I know the Shaido are supposed to be the despised clan among the Aiel, but good lord, these guys basically don't even act like Aiel. They run all over the place taking people Gaishane that are not supposed to be Gaishane. They don't follow Jiato. They don't do this, they don't do that. It's like, why are they even... And then the other wise ones in Carrion except Sivana as a wise one. And they... the whole thing is so bizarre to me. I didn't even understand why that worked for a minute. Moving on, it looks like Sivana's world is starting to unravel a little bit at the seams, and none too soon in my book. The Meriden are leaning, and speaking of the Meriden, we have poor Roland. Poor Roland. He actually seems like a pretty nice guy.
All that poor man wanted was just a little loving.
Yeah, he didn't want much.
Yeah, but I mean, it's also that weird kind of... Yeah, I know you're married, but, you know, maybe I can change your mind, or maybe it only takes just this, you know, this one little act, and you get what you want, and I get what I want, and honestly, it's just a little too lascivious for me.
He continues to say that, you know, what happens while you wear white is forgotten when you put off the white, so evidently it's kind of an ideal thing. If something happens while you're Gaishane, it doesn't affect you when you're not. You know, sort of what happens in Vegas stays in Vegas sort of attitude about it. Weird, huh? But that's what they seem to do.
True, but he's also at the same time, you know, saying this to someone whose culture is so vastly different from his own that, you know, the first three times she says, you know, no, I'm not going to do this, you should probably take the point at that, you know, and be like, well, you know, obviously, if I'm going into, you know, if I go to Vegas and, you know, I point out 3 or 4 times, no, that's not something I'm going to do, then you should probably take the hint that I'm not going to do it.
I still think he's not just quite, you know, I just want a little, and we'll be done, and I'll just help you out if you, you know, give me some special attention. I think it's more of, you know, I want you to, you know, go for this little step and then maybe work it up to not necessarily leaving Perrin, but, ultimately her becoming his, you know, wife in some sort of fashion, whether Perrin's, like, you know, husband number one and he's number two, like his culture says it's okay for.
Yeah, I mean, I totally agree that, you know, he does want more than just, you know, a little immediate, yes, as you say, special attention.
Can I also point out how he's, like, almost like Perrin, just with, you know, Shido pasted over him?
A little bit. As much as any Aiel is likely to be, I suppose. I sort of got a little bit different read from him. It seemed to me that, you know, he had a crush on her. He was, you know, willing to go for it and trying to win her over, and he does, either she remarks in her point of view or he does, that the Aiel admire persistence in a man. That's one of the things that makes them attractive. And so he's certainly persistent. So I think he's not only out to try and woo her and, you know, get as much as he can out of the relationship. I think he's genuinely a nice guy, figures it's not going to hurt her. Hey, she's a guy, Shane. That's what we do. It's no big deal. You know, she'll get over it. She'll be fine. Her husband never has to know. And maybe something more will come of it. But then I think there's also a big element that all of these Meriden were basically just bored out of their minds. There's nothing to do. There's so many Guy Shane around. There's not any real work for anybody to do. So they're all just basically sitting around getting drunk, or in his case, instead of getting drunk, he's sitting around trying to make whoopee with Fael because something to do.
True. And honestly, when the chips are down, Roland does the right thing, you know, and basically says, you forget everything I've said. And this is, of course, getting way, way ahead of ourselves in this recap. Forget what I said earlier, and that I'm taking you out of here. I'll leave you once we're past the point of danger. You know, just as long as you are safely out, you'll be fine. And, you know, he does the right thing, and of course, doing the right thing doesn't help him at all.
No, it didn't. But I think that was always in his mind. I think, you know, he would have been up for anything that he could get out of that relationship, obviously. But I think he was basically a gentleman. I mean, he certainly could have just forced her and had his way with her. I mean, she's Guy Shane. You know, she could have never resisted him for more than 22 seconds, no matter what she did. And obviously, the Shido were getting away with that right and left, because the Meriden sort of appointed Fael and her little party. They sort of appointed themselves protectors to Fael and her little party. So, yeah, I think there were a lot of things going there. That, you know, they did have some cultural differences, but I think if, I don't know if it could ever have worked out, even if, say, Perrin had died and she'd found out, because they are just from such different cultures. I can't see her staying with the Aiel, and I can't see him running off to Saladar, but I think he was just out for, you know, making the best of a bad situation all the way around, for her and for him.
True. I do kind of have a slight sticking point there with your assessment of him. I don't think he could have forced himself on her, because, yes, the Shido were doing that, but I think there's a point in one of his point of views where he makes, you know, a comment that, you know, that sort of treatment to a Guy Shane would be similar to that sort of treatment to a child. And that idea that his honor, you know, his Gieto wouldn't have allowed him to just, you know, force himself on Fael if he wanted it. I think part of it is that he did have to convince her, you know, to willingly partake with him of that particular arrangement for his honor to be satisfied. Now, like I said, once again, hypothetical, and it doesn't really matter at all one way or the other, but I do kind of think that he has that mindset that there are some things you can do with Guy Shane just because you are not Guy Shane and they are, and certain things you most definitely cannot.
Oh, I agree 100%. He actually says to her that the Meriden want to leave because the Shido sickened them, and he also says he should never have taken her Guy Shane because she doesn't follow Gieto, is implied. He didn't say that, but he says, I never should have taken you Guy Shane. I didn't mean that, you know, because he could have got away with it, that he would have, but if he had been that sort of man, he could have got away with that, because the Shido were getting away with molesting the Guy Shane right, left, and center. Just because his honor was sufficient to keep him from doing that doesn't mean he couldn't have. If he'd really wanted to, he could have done it, but he wouldn't. And that's all the difference. It's sort of like, you know, Tuon with the channeling, you know, I'm not like them because I choose not to. I won't do it, and there's the end of it. So that finishes up chapter, unless you have some other point here, something that leads to discussion.
I was actually going to bring up the binder. Do you guys think that it might, play an integral part anywhere down the line?
Well, it's off with Therava now. She's got it in her possession again, so I don't know if we're ever going to see Galena or Therava or the Binding Rod again, so I don't know.
Yeah, I still think that there seemed to be some sort of nudge in one of the earlier chapters where Galena, actually it was the prologue, where Galena wonders if one binder can be used to undo the oaths placed on you by a different binder. We don't know, but I thought there might be a little something to that. But once again, that's a RAFO.
Yeah, that's a whole other series of discussions, which maybe we should make a note of to bring up again. She stakes her all on getting this rod in the hope that it will unbind her, but we don't actually know, and she doesn't actually know if it really will. I sort of come down on the side that probably one rod can be used to unbind another's oath. I think all the oath rods are probably interchangeable that way, but I certainly could be wrong because I have absolutely no proof about that. It just makes more sense to me. I would at some point in time really like to get into a discussion of whether the oath rods are possibly some of the nine, or similar to the nine rods of dominion that are spoken of in the prologue of the first book, et cetera, et cetera. I think there's a lot of possibility to go into that, but not now.
I just have stuff for it, but I'll hold my tongue for now. I think we are done with chapter 5 now.
Okay, so moving on to the next chapter. Chapter 6, A Stave and a Razor, is one of the first of a long series of chapters that deal mainly with Matt, and appropriately, the first point of view is Matt's. And I apologize, I'm going to read this almost directly from the Encyclopedia Watt. Encyclopedia-Watt.org did the summary on this one. Matt is with Val and Luca and Littell early the morning after Renna's death. The dice started rolling in Matt's head again. Luca plans to stay at Jurador 2 more days, but Matt is getting anxious and wants to leave for Lugard. Matt leaves Luca's wagon and passes Petra and Clarine warming up for their axe. He then walks into the town of Jurador. There are no dead people on the road today, for which he is grateful. They must surely have had something to do with Ptarmigan and Rand. The colors then swirl, and he sees Rand and Min kissing. In the town, Matt buys a stave of black yew, which shocks him to find it available because he thought that only grew in the Two Rivers, and he intends to carve a longbow from it. He visits a stable, he visits many stables looking for a horse. He's looking for a particular horse that he wants. In a stable next to an inn called the 12 Salt Wells, he then negotiates with the owner, Toka Ferrum, and the grooms Adela and Hurd show him horses. Matt ends up buying a Razor, a very fine black-and-white horse from Aradomon. She is even finer than Pips in her confirmation. Matt's father taught him how to bargain, as well as how to judge horses. Back at the menagerie show, Aludra takes delivery of barrels of fireworks ingredients, and evidently the horses and teams as well. Matt is still thinking on her need for a Bellfounder. He leaves the stave in the wagon that he shares with Agianan and Domon and goes to Tuon's wagon. Mistress Anan is not there, but Tuon, Noel, Alver, and Seleucia are. Noel tells stories about the Ayad. Matt does not like the influence that Vannon, Harden, and the other Red Arms have on Alver. Oliver still enjoys snakes and foxes. Matt enjoys being with Tuon and thinks she's beautiful. Lopin and Nerum try to keep Matt's clothes clean, even though he does his best to thwart them in that. Matt begins calling Tuon precious to counter her calling him toy. Matt then asks Noel if he is related to Jane Charon. Noel freezes up and then says that he was a cousin. This excites Oliver tremendously because Oliver's favorite book is The Travels of Jane Farstrider. Oliver is now staying in a tent with Julin and Thera. Noel says that Jane was a fool who went on adventures while his wife was at home and died of a fever. He says he let himself be made into a tool by, and then his face goes blank. Alver recalls that Jane Charon captured Cohen Gamalin after he betrayed Malkier to the Shadow, and that he deserves credit for that. Matt is obviously very concerned that Alver will be put off of his very favorite book, and he doesn't like the fact that Noel is saying these things to Alver. Julin then enters and reports that Shanchen soldiers have arrived across the road from the menagerie.
Yeah, we'd like to thank Encyclopedia Watt one more time. All of the summaries that we have used are originally based off of the summaries posted there. It is a wonderful, wonderful resource for any need, whether you want to find out a general summary of what has happened in a chapter, or whether you want to look up a particular character and see the various major important events surrounding them. Would you want to look up a group of individuals? Encyclopedia Watt is a wealth of wonderful, wonderful information, all taken directly from the Wheel of Time series.
That's right. It's really an excellent resource, and we're very grateful to have it. So what do you guys think about this chapter? It's kind of a pivotal chapter for Matt in a lot of ways, I think, but I don't remember why.
It's pivotal because he's buying her, or Lyalwyn Shipless says it's good that you bought a higher, you know, breed of horse, a higher standard gift for her, because that shows that you are giving her her right places. She's above you.
Yeah, she clues him in a little bit on the customs of courting in Shanchen. She tells him it was a very clever gift, that mare, and that it's always best, you know, when you're courting someone higher than yourself, to give them a gift, you know, that's connected to one of their personal pleasures. And it's well known that Tuon likes horses, so she thinks that was pretty smart. And Matt doesn't know any of that. He's just flying by the seat of his pants, doing the best he can, because he feels really at sea with her.
What do you think about Noel and his possible foreshadowing of him actually coming out and being Jane Farstrider as opposed to the cousin he, you know, claims to be?
Well, I think the idea that he claims to be a cousin is nearly direct proof that he is, particularly with that line that was mentioned. He let himself be made a tool by, and then, like, his face goes blank. And, I mean, it's not like, you know, oop, I said something I shouldn't have. It's like something clicked in his brain, like, you know, oh, this is the trigger in, you know, that was placed in my brain by the one power that means I don't talk about this. I just suddenly go very quiet.
Yeah, he reminds me a little bit of the Gollum character in Lord of the Rings. You know, he's been manipulated by the shadow in some way that we don't really know. Not in the way that Padan Fain was, but he was definitely tainted by it a little bit. And I don't think that he's a dark friend, personally, but I think there's a lot going on with him that we haven't really been allowed to see yet. And it's very possible that he may end up in some pivotal crisis moment doing something that's completely unexpected to either to hurt one of the main characters or to further them along.
The interesting thing, too, with him, and it leads back again to that quote, you know, he let himself be made a tool by. And wasn't there something in the early books where Ishii, as Bala Zamon, makes reference to, you know, I took that fool, Jane Farstrider, and, you know, made him dance at my whim or something like that?
I think he says, I took Jane Farstrider and painted him for a fool and then turned him loose, you know, to make his way.
He's one of the two characters who bring up the Eye of the World that changes Moraine's mind on where they're going. See, that was his big fool's play in book one.
Well, we assume that he's the person that the Ogier tell Moraine has come to one of the Steaden and given them the story about Sightblinder or whatever, trying to blind the Eye of the World. But they were never told directly that it is Jane Farstrider, but we can assume that from all the things that have happened since.
I thought there was, like, a big reference. I thought they almost openly said it.
I don't think so. I think it was implied. Anyway, whatever Noel's role is going to be, I've always thought that, obviously, that Noel is probably going to be found to be Jane Farstrider. And if that's true, then, you know, he's a Malkieri like Lon. Is that going to have any, you know, impact on Lon down the road, you think?
I don't really know. I mean, it depends on, because Jane has always seemed to me to be one of those characters that is outside of the realm of, like, politics. Like, you know, if it comes out as, you know, like, all of them all, we'll get into this later in the recap and that, but, you know, as the Malkyrie gather to follow the Golden Crane, you know, he seems like he'd be the one that goes, oh, so there's a king going that way doing stuff. That's awesome. I'm still doing my thing because I'm me.
Or he, because he's under compulsion.
Because I'm me.
Because he's under compulsion.
And the compulsion says I'm me.
We'll find out in the next exciting episode. Well, maybe not our episode, but in the next book, perhaps.
Dude, we have foretelling. In our next exciting episode, we will predict what happens.
And then you can laugh at us when we're wrong and praise us if we're right. I think one of my other favorite parts of this thing, apart from buying the horse, which to me, I can't think of anything except a zebra in my mind with black and white meeting together in straight lines slashing down. I thought, oh, who would want to ride that? But one of my favorite little byplays is, you know, that Matt thinks that Vannon and the Red Arms are having a bad influence on Oliver, and Oliver is so clearly imitating Matt to the nines. It's just hysterical.
Oh, yeah. No, that's absolutely priceless. It's like, I don't know where he gets all of these ideas. Well, look in the mirror there, Matt.
Yeah. That's pretty funny. I don't know. It's just one of those little, it's like the running jokes that go through the whole thing. It just cracks me up. And this business about Matt calling Tuon precious, that was kind of an interesting little byplay, too. It didn't last very long, but I thought it was kind of an endearing little game that they're playing with each other. Matt, he's just like, he reminds me back a couple of books where he's dancing with that serving maid, Betsy, I think was her name, Betsa or something like that. And Nalestian and Talmanis are, you know, humming Frog on the Ice under their breath. You know? He's skidding around with his feet up in the air. He has no clue what he's doing. He's trying so hard to make head or tail of what she wants out of him and what she should do about her. And he's not doing too bad, but he's pretty much out of his element with her.
Yeah. The thing is with Matt buying the horse, I really do feel that, you know, that's good old Matt. I mean, that gets us back to some of the early Matt, you know, that we see in that. Not directly what he's grown into, because obviously what he's grown into is a part of who he used to be as well. But, I mean, it kind of goes solidly back to that, you know, well, my da taught me everything about, you know, horses. And, you know, just, it was a very nice thing to see. I really just like how Matt manages to maintain who he was in the midst of growing into the hero that he is.
Yeah, absolutely. And obviously he feels on very firm ground with the horses because he knows them and knows everything about them and how to, you know, select them and evaluate them and so forth. So I think he felt he was going to get a little bit of his own back with her there. And actually he did. You know, that was a very endearing gift, and she accepted it with no, you know, little cutting remarks or sarcasm or any game playing like she did with the little, you know, flowers that he was bringing her for a while. Or, God forbid, the necklace. Oh, that was just rude. That was very endearing, and it made me like Matt all the more. And honestly, he could give me a horse anytime.
Yeah, I mean, I also did like the entire precious thing, because it was one of those, you can kind of see that Matt was originally doing it specifically to kind of point out to her how horribly demeaning it was for her to call him Toy all the time instead of his name. And it became this little game thing that, you know, in some ways Matt didn't even realize he was playing. They were just kind of like, he just kind of like, well, I'm getting my own back at you now. And she's sitting there thinking to herself, okay, so this is how we're going to play it now. We'll see which of us can last longer in this.
I think it's kind of nice you get the flip of the coin where Perrin has his little Two River kind of naivety or whatever, where it's just kind of like, oh, well, I said what I meant, and people are like, oh, there's something behind that, where Matt's like, it's like, oh, here's what I say, and it's totally taken the wrong way and backfires on him.
Yeah. I think the other thing that really struck me as significant in this chapter, and I'm not sure how it's going to play out in the long run, is the stave of Black Yew. I mean, he had to abandon his bow in Ebedar when he decamped with eventually Tuon in tow. But why at this point in time, Matt's grown so much into having the Ashandarai and the quarterstaff. Why does he feel like he needs the longbow again? And is that going to be, I mean, is that also tied into the prophecy somehow? Or is that something that, you know, he's feeling compelled that he wants to have again because of his own past in the Two Rivers? Or is that, you think that's something more, you know, in his larger past lives that's drawing him? Is it going to be significant, do you think? Or is it just another, you know, cute little byplay?
See, I don't know, because, you know, as we're fond of pointing out, Robert Jordan very rarely puts something in one of these books that is mentioned so explicitly that isn't significant in some way, shape, or form. I do think the idea of a nice Two Rivers longbow, coming back into play, because Matt was really also one of the really good ones with the bow in the original few books. That maybe that idea of him carrying a bow again will play some interesting part. I found it also interesting, and I know it's not a direct correlation, but Matt has a lot of black symbology about him. He's got a wide-brimmed black hat. He wears a black scarf to hide his hanging scar. The haft and the blade of the Ashendar. Now he's buying a black wood or a black yew stave to make into a bow. It seems really interesting that, like I said, I don't think black yew is exactly, black. I don't think it's like an ebony color or anything, but it just seems like there's a lot of, dark imagery with Matt's accessories. And it just seemed a little interesting to me.
Well, and I hesitate to call her an accessory, but Tuon is a black woman, too.
I was going to bring it up that his black hat and all his little black symbology or symbolism kind of seems to me like it's helping out with integrating him into the Shan Chant with the Black Ravens and the Death Watch Guard being black and red, and just using a little bit of color coordination to kind of ease him into the idea of it.
Well, first of all, the Shan Chant Death Watch Guards are not black and red. They're dark, dark, dark green and red. They get a little bit miffed if you call it black. And I think the only people that really have the black and red colors are Morden and Mazrim Taim. But did we mention his scarf? Yeah, his scarf's black. I think you did mention that. The only thing I thought was odd is that Pips isn't black. I think he's just a, mouse-colored horse of some sort. Nothing special. I was kind of surprised that, obviously he likes a plain horse, and he sort of reminds me of the certain class of, usually kids, that are car racers who have a really old, beat-up car that they've totally maxed out as far as the engine and everything else, so it looks like a clunker, but, can really win all the street races, or Han Solo's Millennium Falcon. It looks like a piece of crud, but it's the fastest ship in this quadrant. Matt's got this very plain horse who doesn't look like anything, but he's got a lot of, staying power and everything. In fact, I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that it just dawned on me, but Matt's character really reminds me a lot of Han Solo.
Wasn't Jordan influenced by Star Wars, too?
God, who wasn't?
Well, I'm saying, the Force, if I'm not mistaken, is, slightly the base point of, the One Power. Of course, it's expanded upon exponentially, but I wouldn't actually be surprised if Matt might have been slightly based, or just the kind of fantasy medieval Han Solo.
Yeah, the two other characters in movies that to me resonate the most strongly with the Matt character are Han Solo, and as I've mentioned before in another podcast, John McClane in the Die Hard movies. The archetypical.
But if that's the case, then who's Greedo?
Padden Fain. I don't know. Except he didn't get offed quick enough.
Thinking about Star Wars character, for some reason I just kind of link Perrin to Chewbacca. Anybody else get that?
Because he's a big, fluffy, curly-headed bear. Aww. A wolf. Excuse me.
Fail.
Yeah, that's it. That's Perrin.
I'm sorry. That
Okay. I started it. Now I'm sorry.
It's obviously because he lost a hand, Rand is Luke Skywalker.
Of course. Duh. That's been like 100% obvious since the beginning.
I just want Shamael to do the whole, Rand, I am your father.
Oh my god, no. That would be carrying it a little too far.
It would be hilarious, though.
Maybe that's the thing that's going to put Rand over the edge in the next book when he finds out that Shamael is really his father and then he kills somebody.
Or not necessarily his father, maybe just his ancestor.
Or wait until he finds out that Morden is really his other half, or third, and he and Morden and Luce Theron will all have to merge together to become one.
Platypus.
Doesn't Rand, like, not own any part of his body or soul? Isn't, like, weaseled away to, like, Luce Theron and the three girls?
I don't know, dude. He's got so many strings on him, I don't think he does own much of himself anymore.
He owns his boots, and that's...
No, he borrowed those from Perrin. No, he didn't. Which wraps up this discussion. I think we've kind of explored about all that we can out of these chapters, and perhaps not. We may think of something else, or perhaps some of you will write in and talk to us about it. Tell us what you think we've missed, or add something to what we've gone over. We always love to hear from you, so feel free to send us a voicemail or an email or anything you like.
Yes, of course, there are always a number of good ways to get a hold of us. If you are within the continental United States, you can leave us a voicemail at 1-888-333-7690.
And you can also email us at podcast@dragonmount.com. And you can also find us on the web where the podcast pages are posted. You can obviously download these from iTunes. You may have already done that and know this. You can also find all of the episodes at www.dragonmount.com/podcast. You can find the entire list of them on one page, or you can find them separated by months. And you can download them there. And each episode page has its own comment section, and we frequently peruse those and chime in with our 2 cents worth.
On DragonMount.com as well, there is also the Fourth Age Forum, which is locatable on their forums page.
We can also be reached at the Fourth Age MySpace and the Fourth Age Facebook.
And you can also follow us on Twitter, where Fourth Age.
But then you can also, on Twitter, follow our host site, DragonMount.com, as well.
Oh, that's right. Jason tweets fairly often on Twitter. Once again, we want to thank you all for listening. We really appreciate it. And we hope that you have as much fun listening to our sometimes silliness and analysis of the real time as we've been doing. We have a great time, and we hope you enjoy it as well. I just want to thank you, Andrew and Morgan, for showing up in this episode. It's great to have you both here, and we will see you next time.
It's always great to be here. Thanks for having me.
And for myself, Andrew Gellos, and everyone here at the Fourth Age, Saravian Ento Manshima, and if you haven't figured it out by now, this episode contained spoilers.
God, too little, too late.